is are in the very early stages. And I'm hoping that you can start at least to begin to enjoy reading actual biblical texts, which is sure a lot more salutary than just hacking through grammar books. We read a week and a half in advance. So we're doing Advent 3 already. Say, did Advent 1 kind of sneak up on everybody? Man. So that we read today the lesson for a week from Sunday, which is already Advent 3, so that if people are, in fact, preaching on some of these texts, you're working far enough in advance that it might be helpful to you. So, Isaiah 61 is the text for today, 1 to 3, and also 10 and 11 at the end of the chapter are part of the lesson. That didn't get in the daily announcements. It's really the whole chapter of Isaiah 61. Why you'd skip those verses, I don't know, but you just can't do everything. So we want to look at 1 to 3 and 10 to 11. Where are we in the book of Isaiah? I mean, place this all a little bit into the context, both the literary and historical context of Isaiah. As you know, almost all scholars believe this is deep into the heart of 3rd Isaiah, making the break from 2nd to 3rd at 55, 56. The point is we're at least in the third part of the book, toward the end of the book. And in general, the themes of God's impending judgment, which dominate the first part of the book, though not exclusively, the basic message of Isaiah is that, yes, God is going to judge, but that from the very beginning, he says, that after judgment comes salvation. It's kind of a classic law-gospel theology at work. But that what you have here toward the end of the book are some of the most beautiful texts of hope and restoration, assuming, of course, that that a certain preaching of the law has had its effect. That 61 is sometimes called the fifth suffering servant psalm is appropriate. As you know, we have these so-called suffering servant motifs in Isaiah, and the last of which is Isaiah 53. And 61 is often cited as kind of more of the same because it talks about this anointed servant going forth in the name of the Lord, or really coming in the name of the Lord. And that Jesus picks this up in Luke 4 is, fairly obvious and to make that connection. Well, let's translate the text. Ruach Adonai Yahweh Alai. Ruach Adonai Yahweh. The spirit of Ruach. The spirit of Adonai Yahweh. Now here again, you have Adonai as the title, Yahweh as the divine name. I would translate this Lord Yahweh, or Adonai Yahweh if you want. Now, this is where NIV always doubles up the sovereignty of God and you get Sovereign Lord, which of course is part of the whole problem of translating Yahweh as L-O-R-D instead of Yahweh. But that's a topic I think you're quite familiar with. The spirit of Adonai Yahweh is, there's no verb, alai, the preposition al, pronominal suffix, upon me. In many ways, this is picking up the theme of Isaiah chapter 11, right? Where we have the anointing of the rootstock, or the little shoot that comes forth from the rootstock of Jesse, and he has anointed me. The Spirit of the Lord is upon the messianic child there as well. So this is kind of coming full circle to that theme, and we have the mashach verb used in the next line, Ya'an mashach Yahweh othi, because mashach is the Hebrew word from which we get the name Messiah, right? Mashach means to anoint. Because Yahweh has mashacht othi, me, direct object. Now, second line, infinitive. Lit baser au anawim shilachani. Lit baser, infinitive. P-A-L, infinitive, root basar. Right by the textbook, regular verb. Basar really means to report, to give the message of a messenger to the people who are waiting. You know, this is usually the picture of the herald coming across the hills to bring back to the city news of the king's victory, or that the army has won. Generally, basar is good news. Hence, the Septuagint here has to evangelize, oiangelizomai. And in many ways, this is kind of the evangelism verb of Hebrew, basar. That assumes, of course, that the news is good. To announce good news, you can almost get out of that, all that out of the verb. But it takes a direct object, and of course the PL would be strongly transitive here. We might simply put in English to evangelize the Anoim, to speak good news to the Anoim. Anoim are really poor, the destitute, the humble. It's not just poor in spirit, but really the humble and the poor and the ones who, frankly, have lives that are rarely filled with good news. Shilakani, he has, that's shilak plus the object suffix. He has sent me. Now we have another infinitive. This is a little awkward just in terms of how you divide up the poetic lines. You got a little too many verb forms. Do you get all this? Shilakani seems to start the next sentence. He has sent me lachbosh lanish bere lev. He has sent me to, another infinitive, kavash, bind up. It means to bandage. Now you think of binding up as tying something up, but it means to wrap with cloths. To bandage, to the nish bere lev. Can you parse that? Nish bere is the nifal participle of shavar. Shavar means to break, nifal broken, to the broken ones of heart. We have the same idiom, brokenhearted, right? Doesn't mean your heart literally got, well, yeah. To bind up the brokenhearted, huh? To bandage the ones broken of heart. Likro, to proclaim, kara, to cry out, almost preach. To preach to the shivu, to the shivuyim, a kal passive participle of shava, to capture or to be captured, the captured ones are in bondage, to proclaim to the captured ones daror. Now this is a key word, daror, a freedom. But it's also the word that is to be proclaimed on the Jubilee year. The Jubilee year. One of the less known connections here is the fact that the Messianic age is directly linked to the theology of the Jubilee year. We don't talk a lot about that because, frankly, there isn't a whole lot. The critics believe the Jubilee year never happened anyway. But assuming that Leviticus has some basis in reality, this was to have been part of their life, but we don't hear a lot about it. So this has all to do with the fulfillment of the promises that have to do with the Jubilee year, which tie God's promises to the whole land and their way of life. Remember, on the Jubilee year, everything went dormant for 2 years. They had the seventh Sabbath, and then they had the kicker year. So you really had a two-year layoff, and all bets were off. All debts were canceled. All property went back to its owner. And this, assuming they actually did this, this must have been quite a significant event to do this in their daily life as the people of God. Sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? All debts are paid. Preferably, your first and second year of seminary would be this would work very well. This is why Jesus stirs up such a hornet's nest when he says, today in your hearing, these words are fulfilled. He's kind of proclaiming a renegade Jubilee year, see? There are some theories that it actually was the Jubilee year, though there's no evidence for that whatsoever. And if it wasn't, well, then, Jesus is kind of trumping the calendar here and saying, hey, it's Jubilee. And that had terrible significance for people. Back to Isaiah, to proclaim to the captives daror, freedom. By the way, this word is also inscribed on a liberty bell, one of the classic misunderstandings of two kingdom theology in American history. And to the asurim, another kal passive participle, these are prisoners. Asar means to throw somebody in jail. and to the prisoners, pekach koach. Here's a word nobody knows what it is. All right? You'll see there's a flag on the play in the footnote, and they're suggesting they do something with it. Pekach means to open. And either it's a scribal error where the scribe fell asleep and wrote the same consonants more than once, which is, you know, always possible. I sometimes think these prophet poets made up words, all right? And this could be a, there is this sort of polale or pilpale formation in Hebrew where you take the second two letters of a root and double them, and it intensifies it. Now, that's all very hypothetical, but if it were true, then what he's saying something like this is to declare to the prisoners, complete and full opening, huh? The gates are wide open. It's not that you got to sneak out a crack in the wall, you see. It's almost like the jailer at Philippi, you know, where suddenly, boom, hey, they can walk out. No one's tending the store. Two. Likro to proclaim Shnath Ratzon Lech Yahweh V'yom Nakam Lelohenu. Oh, what a line, huh? Nice Hebrew parallelism. To cry out, proclaim. Shnath is the construct of Shana, the year of Ratzon belonging to Yahweh. All right, the Lamed here is probably possessive. Yahweh's year. Now, Ratzon's a loaded word. All right, this is one of the big grace words in the Old Testament. Usually tied to the sacrificial system. You get it in Isaiah 40. Comfort, comfort, to proclaim that her sins are forgiven, that her iniquity is ratzad. It's the same verb, declared acceptable. It's a year of God's acceptable, or what would you say, favorable declaration that everything's okay. Coupled with that, in poetic parallelism, is Yom Nakam. Now, this generally gets translated Day of Vengeance, Nakam, Vengeance. And that's really a bad translation. We tend to hear of vengeance as something you take off against your enemy because he's pushed you once too often. And it really has to do with justice, huh? That a justice system is intended to do, in a sense, vengeance in the proper sense. To have the punishment fit the crime. So while it is more of a punishment motif, it's not necessarily a negative concept. But note how it's paired with grace. I mean, you kind of have the two sides of God's judgment day here put together. It's both a day of judgment and a day full of grace at the same time. And for Lutherans, this is never a problem because we're so used to looking at the coin as having a law and gospel side. But it's a nice little juxtaposition. To proclaim the year of Ratzon belonging to Yahweh and the day of Nakam, of vengeance, if you will, of divine justice and appropriate retribution belonging to Eloheinu, our God. Linachem kol avelim. Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, as long as you hear that in sort of a proper way, yeah, well, legal, correctly meted out. L'nachem, to Nachem is, Isaiah 40 starts this way, Nachmu, Nachmu, Ami, comfort, comfort my people, and it's a comfort word. To comfort all the Avalim, the mourning ones, this is M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, mourning ones, to place to the mourning ones of Zion, to give to them, lateth lahem. Do you see the syntax, or there are too many words here. That doesn't really bother me, but it always bothers somebody. It's a little repetitious. I think it's almost a rhetorical effect that he's kind of holding, making them wait for the direct object. To comfort all, it's almost, this is called staircase parallelism, where you pick up one motif and bring it to the next line, and then pick up another motif and bring it to the next line. To comfort all who mourn, to give to the mourning ones in Zion. Now you've picked up the mourning from one line of the X, but you haven't said what it is you're going to give to them. Then you get to give to them, and now you finally get to the direct object, pe'er. If you're not used to reading the Hebrew text, that you got to go up a line and catch the brackets there. That's the end of this line. To give to them a pe'er tachat efer, We probably don't get the wordplay that well, but you can see that pe'er and afer have the same consonants, all right? So there's probably a word place, this is a pun. To give to them pe'er, what's pe'er? Honor, glory, usually something you wear that is to your honor. You know, like a nice piece of jewelry, or boy, I got a brand new tie, might be our little brooch that says I'm special because somebody gave me this. To give to them honor instead of afer is ashes, the sackcloth and ashes stuff. So the reversal here is also a wordplay on these two words. Now there's more. There are more reversals. Shemen, say this. Shemen sason, tachath evil. Shemen sason, oil of rejoicing, tachath instead of evil, instead of mourning. By the way, evil, you see that word, a beginning Hebrew, guys? This would be an example of what kind of a noun. Evil. Note the accent on the first syllable, a segol in the second syllable. This is one of them near segolet nouns we were talking about this morning. Ma'ate, a mantle. This is like a cloak of tihilah. Tihilah is from the verb halal, which you know from the word hallelujah, praise, hallelujah. It's the noun. A mantle of praise instead of a ruach keha, instead of a weak. Keha just means weak, faint. A faint ruach, a weak spirit. Boy, is that great stuff, huh? I mean, all these kind of reversals, and there's all sorts of word and sound play going on. Yeah, a garment of praise. I mean, what kind of application can you make with that? It's like you wear the robes that are praise to God. Next line, v'korah. Now, anyone want to parse korah? This is a major league verb form. Korah is the pu'al, irregular, because you can't double a middle letter. It will be called to them Elei HaTzedek, oaks of the righteousness, a planting of Yahweh, Lehith Pa'er, the Hith Pa'el, for revealing praise. Hith Pa'er, it's the same Pa'er we just had for the glory word. A mantle of Yahweh, actually the Hith Pa'el means to boast, to take praise for oneself, for boasting. And of course the key is knowing who it is about which we're boasting here, right? Paul has something to say about that. We got to quit. And we go to 10 and 11. We don't have time to do the intervening verses, but it's kind of more of the same. This is all talking about they're rebuilding the walls. You got this great line in there about them all becoming priests. It's kind of the eschatological priesthood of all believers. But then you get to 10, which is kind of a summary. We got to do this real quick so we can get to the Greek. Here's sos again. We just had sason. It's the same verb. Infinitive absolute asis is the kal imperfect. Greatly I will rejoice in Yahweh. Tagil nafshi. My nefesh will rejoice in Elohai, my God. This is the same tagil that you have in the Hebrew song Hava Nagil. Nagil. Gil is the verb to rejoice. Because Hil Bishani, he will clothe me. Lavash means to put on clothes, but in the Hifil, he will clothe me. Begeds of Yesha, a beged is a garment, garments of salvation. What a wardrobe. Ma'il Tzedakah, Ma'il is the sort of a cloak or what they call a mantle. This is kind of the flowing thing that rich people wear. An outer garment of righteousness, he will cover me. Like a bridegroom, this is a great little line, it's difficult Hebrew. Like a katan is a bridegroom, yikahain is really the PL verb form. You know this as a noun, kohain, priest. Like a bridegroom verbally acts like a priest with reference to a pe'er, A pe'er would be his, again, adornment, kind of a glorious thing. You know, the priests were supposed to look pretty sharp in their, not in their personal dress, but in their liturgical garb, right? As a sign of glory and praise and the good things that we identify with the relationship with God that they represented. And the same kind of garments then were worn by brides and grooms in a wedding ceremony, which created in a personal life something kind of on the same model as our relationship between God and His church. And you've got that theme here. Like a bridegroom dandies himself up like a priest, and like a bride adorns herself with her stuff. Kale is really the word for stuff. Because like the land, Aretz causes to come out its tzemach, its sprout, its growth, and like a garden, the stuff that's planted, zeru is from zerah to sow, its sown stuff, tatzmiach, hifil of tzemach, causes it to spring forth. So, last line, thus, Adonai Yahweh, we start where we end where we started with Adonai Yahweh, will cause to bring forth, to sprout up, to grow from the ground, to grow tzedakah and tehillah and praise, neged kol hagoyim. Don't miss the last line. So Adonai Yahweh will cause to grow righteousness and praise, neged kol hagoyim, opposite, over against, in the front of all the goyim, all the nations. Why? So they might see the glory of God as we are privileged to wear it. We got to quit. Quick question. No, they're going to say Adonai Yahweh. They haven't. They're still saying Yahweh in the Old Testament. I don't think lightning ever struck.